Our 11th meeting of Education Innovation Policy will come to order. Happy Valentine's, everyone. And this morning, members, we have Paige's visiting us again. So I would like to ask these high school students to, one at a time, come to the microphone that you see in front of you and say your name and where you're from, the high school. Thank you. We'll begin, sir, with you.
I'm Michael Watkins from Austin, Minnesota.
Welcome. Next.
I'm Aubrey Giesen. I'm from Glencoe Silver Lake.
Welcome.
I'm Julia Hoffman, and I'm from Starbuck, Minnesota.
Welcome.
Lucas Pearson from Butterfield, Minnesota.
Welcome.
I'm James Wasted. I'm from Buffalo High School.
Welcome.
My name is Grace Johnson. I'm from Shakopee, Minnesota.
Welcome.
Imani Cornelius from Shakopee, Minnesota.
Welcome.
Nick Swanson from Vadnais Heights, Minnesota.
Welcome. Very good to have all of you. Steve, is that all of them?
Yep.
Very good. And thank you for attending our meeting so early in the morning and for listening carefully to those bills that we will hear today, because they do involve you. As you know, we set policy that then your school districts follow if it's a mandate or consider if it's an encouragement. So we are so glad to have you. And we lead off this morning with Representative Pryor. Would you approve the minutes, please, from February 9? So moved. Representative Pryor moves the minutes of February 9, 2017, for approval. Are there any corrections or additions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Pryor. Our first bill this morning is Representative Quam, House File 675. Representative Quam, I will move House File 675 to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Welcome to our committee, Representative Quam. Please explain your House file.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Basically, I think it was a year ago in the Finance Committee, there was testimony on the EpiPen bill. And it's one of the testifiers brought up inhaler, you know, that they had a situation and they were able to, because the circumstances worked out, utilize the inhaler to help a student. And so this bill was brought to me. I remember that testimony. I thought, you know, we should look at allowing school districts, if they so choose, to have inhalers available for use for emergency, whether the nursing staff, you know, if they have the coaches trained, you know, there'd be certain situations to be useful. And so that's the intent. I've had some discussions, somewhat energetic, with the School Nurses Association, and you can tell that this year is the starting bill, and I think in the HHS committee that appropriately we would address what medical parameters and concerns should be added, and I have asked for interested parties to present amendment language to me. But the intent is to look and see if we can allow an option that would help some students in some school districts.
Thank you, Representative Quam. I believe we have a page who probably uses an inhaler. Would you come forward, say your name again for the record, and make your comments about the use of an inhaler?
Hi, I'm Julia Hoffman, and growing up, I, in kindergarten through most of my elementary, I used an inhaler at school, and I would always, I'd have to have it in the nurse's office, and I'd always take it before PE, but, yeah. And it was always nice to have on hand, just in case, because I had to take it every day also, so.
Thank you, Ms. Hoffman. With that, Representative Palm, I believe we have some in the audience who would like to lend support or concern. And so Grace Kelleher from the Minnesota School Boards Association, will you come forward? And then the Minnesota Nurses, Deb Meyer, and Gary Amoroso from the superintendents. Be on deck, please. Welcome. Say your name and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association, and my association represents elected boards from around the state. And as we reviewed Representative Palm's bill and spoke to him about it, we do have concerns about that. And I think maybe the first concern is the most obvious. Presently in law, we have 121A.221, possession and use of asthma inhalers by asthmatic students. So if you look through that, there's a Part A and a Part B, and it talks about a school nurse and an action plan, and that the student possesses the knowledge and skills to safely possess and use an asthma inhaler in a school setting. And they enter into the student's health plan. So it talks about when schools have nurses and when they don't. And once again, that's a parent or guardian submitting written verification from the prescribing professional. The documents assess the knowledge and skills to safely possess and use an asthma inhaler. And that's pretty much what we are doing right now, much like the student was just up here shared. It is not clear to me why we would go so far as 675. The only thing I can compare it to is similar to what we did with EpiPens a few years ago, and we found that to be problematic because the law reads Epi injectors. A lot of school districts feel the Mylan product at $400 or $500 is the one they need to have, and they last 6 months to a year. So we're replacing that stock whether we use it or not. I think the same concern is here. Asthma inhalers, you know, I always assumed they were going to be really cheap and available to all kids, and they're $50 or $60 a piece. And it's only a one-time use, and they're gone. And I do have an ongoing concern that school districts sort of put education to the side and start becoming medical centers. And I think then you need to think about diabetes and insulin. And I am fortunate enough this morning to have a school nurse next to me who deals with those issues. So with that, I will turn it over, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kelleher. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name and begin.
My name is Deb Mayer. Thank you for having me. I am the health services coordinator currently with District 196, the Rosemont Apple Valley Egan School District. And have been a licensed school nurse for 14 years, practicing in an elementary school. And we have come a long way. We do allow students to carry their own inhalers and EpiPens if they are able to do so. The concerns that we have, the school personnel to administer the asthma inhaler without a prescription, and we're wondering who the school personnel are and how they're trained, what medications would be available, and how would we determine what those medications would be. How would school personnel decide when and how to administer, and what the potential liabilities would be for the school districts and the personnel that administer those medications? And then when we talk about the administering the asthma inhaler, not practicing medicine, that's a concern as well. Concerned also for the practicing of nursing and how that would relate. Typically, the nurse follows that asthma action plan. It includes a pretty substantial assessment in some cases. That might be oximetry reading, auscultation of lung sounds, peak flow measurement, and just wondering who would be doing that assessment. And if there's not a medical evaluation diagnosing the asthma, how is it not practicing medicine for somebody to make that determination if there isn't already a prescription available for the student or community person? And then how would a district decide how many inhalers to stock? And how could they absorb the cost? Our school district, my school district, has 27,000 students. And of those 27,000, we have 22,273 that are known diagnosed asthmatics. I spoke to Cub Pharmacy last night, and their cost, they said, For a Ventolin inhaler is $72.49, and a ProAir is $77.99. I did the math. It's not new math. $164,000 up to $177,000 if we just supplied for those people that we know have asthma. Again, they're single use. How would you help out the rest of the students as well? Again, why not diabetes medication, seizure medication? And we're thinking rather than provide service for students one diagnosis at a time, employ a licensed school nurse that can meet the needs, the healthcare needs and educational needs of all the student population. That's where we're coming from. Thank you for your time, and I would take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Mayor. You raised some really important questions. Are there questions for her, Representative Makeway?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have asthma. Are inhalers all the same? Do they do different things? How does that work?
They do different
Ms. Mayor.
Things. I'm sorry. They do different things. And there are different types of inhalers. There are some that reduce the secretions that the student is popping up or the person is popping up and then popping up. And then there are also some that reduce the inflammation. So you have kind of a steroid, and then you have combinations of both of those as well.
Representative Makeway.
Madam Chair, and so if you were looking at a student who was having an asthma attack, would you know which type to give if you didn't know before?
I would follow the asthma action plan that the physician filled out and the parents have provided that to the school. So I don't actually make the determination which one they get.
Madam Chair.
Makeway.
So if you hadn't had a plan from a doctor before, would you know which one to give?
I would be reluctant.
Okay.
Are there other questions for the testifier? Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you seeing in your school district situations coming up where a child forgets their inhaler and everybody's scrambling around saying, well, what do we do, and you wish you had one on stock, or is this maybe
that
a...
That happens sometimes.
Ms. Mayor.
I'm sorry. That happens sometimes. What we did find with the EpiPen bill was that students stopped sending the EpiPens to school. So it was supposed to support students in education and keep them safe when actually... Now, we only stocked two, but in my same elementary school, we had 37 students that had EpiPens, and we stocked two. So if, and we had an instance where we had a bunch of wasp stings at one of our elementary schools and ended up administering a lot of EpiPens. So theoretically, it could happen. We have not had any deaths from lack of asthma inhalers at our schools.
Representative Konish-Kudin.
Thank you. What is the current plan for these students? Do they bring in, and at the elementary level, do they bring in their inhaler and then turn it into the nurse and then come to see you as they need it? And is that a plan that works well?
Ms. Mayor.
It's kind of a combination, and it's determined between the healthcare provider and the parents, and then if there is a nurse at the school. A lot of students do carry their own inhalers, and that's absolutely acceptable. We're all about education and supporting independence, and that helps students get to that goal. If they can recognize when they need to use it and use it appropriately, that's fantastic, and we're all for that. So there's different paperwork for self-carry, self-administer, and then there's another round of paperwork where the health personnel are going to help them with that.
Thank you. Representative Klinsky.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think with that, any other questions from members? Let's go to Mr. Amoroso.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, testifiers. Welcome, Mr. Amoroso. Please say your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Gary Amoroso, Executive Director, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, representative superintendents and other district-level administrators. Most of the comments have been made, so very briefly I want to thank Representative Kwan for his statement that he's willing to continue looking at the bill and addressing some of the concerns that he's heard. Very quickly, three concerns. School personnel, the way I see it, could be any individual that's employed by the school district. That would cause us concern. What's the expertise those people would have in making that snap decision? There is nothing more important than the safety and health of our students. And having a person who may not have the training be empowered by state statute to do something with an inhaler, even if the child didn't have a prescription, or if they had a prescription, what if the person makes a mistake? What if they, in their best judgment, felt this is what they had observed and needed, and it actually does harm to the child? So that concerns us. And then lastly, what type of liability would be associated with that type of decision that the individual would bear and the school district would bear? But again, our perspective is that there is nothing more important than the health and safety of our students. So we want to make sure that any law that gets passed provides that student with the best possible care, and we appreciate that Representative Kwan is willing to continue to have the conversations. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Amoroso. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kwan, I'm just really concerned about this. I think everybody is, and we understand the intent and wanting to save lives and keep kids comfortable and safe. I was just looking up EMT paramedic responses, and they're required to have training in order to administer a physician-prescribed medication. There is no contingency in anything that I've found that says an EMT can come in and say, oh, this child is having an asthma attack, give me an inhaler and we'll take care of this. They could do that under the direction of a physician on the phone, I think, but they could not, even a trained EMT could not do that. So I'm just concerned about the things that other people have suggested. What do we do about the training of the staff that are going to be responsible for this?
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you bring up a good point. My wife was the president of the Byron First Responders for about a decade. Both my sons and my wife served in volunteer ambulance services. And so I understand the legal ramifications around that. I also, having been on the school board, not as long as one of our peers, but being on a school board, realize that every school district has a procedure and has had for decades, and it's available to anyone that comes to the office, and most of them, I think, are online now, covering any situations. And so where the bill says schools may obtain, that is permissive. And having been on the school board, we would have a procedure if we'd wish to do this, which would go over training, uses. Some school districts may wish to just have available so that if an EMT, ambulance, first responder comes, they have that available in a situation so that the school district has full control whether they decided to have this available or not. And every school district that I've ever been involved with, before they would allow anything, they have a very stringent development of the policies, procedures, who is allowed to, who isn't, and what training they may require. And so I purposely, when this bill was brought to me, didn't try to have 47 pages dictating everything. I think there needs to be some, background, guideline, et cetera, included. But frankly, the school district knows its students. The school district knows its personnel. And the school district would generate an appropriate policy, or if they didn't feel comfortable with the skill, training, capabilities of its staff, they just would not take advantage of the May and not have this. So I know this is the beginning of the discussion, but, frankly, I think, we can get to the path where if a district chose, and every 4 years at a school site, your population is different. So that evolution, you may have several students that have, asthma, and then you may, not 4 years later. So that dynamic is known by the local district, which it's not a name, it's not a number. These are kids. Mm-hmm. And so this would be, the intent is to empower them, the prudence to cover the issues would be on the school district, but also, you know, as we go into the HHS committee, have the appropriate, you know, stipulations that you would need to have a training program, et cetera. But I didn't, even though I've been around that and understand the aspects, didn't want to try to impose language. And that's why it's always better to bring stakeholders together and have a holistic approach to come up with a bill that does address. And I hope I covered your questions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ward.
One quick follow-up. Well, I appreciate the fact that it's May, but my experience is that often in these situations, May evolves to become shall and or will. And so that concerns me that we're starting down a path that maybe we're not ready to do. The other thing is I think it would be more important to train staff, like we're going to, you know, add on to training, but to train staff to be aware of the growing things, the growing incident. People don't go into an asthma attack without some history. There's some, you know, we need to be paying attention to mold and those kinds of things that people are sensitive to, and children in particular. But if a staff isn't trained to recognize that until it gets to a crisis point, then I'm really concerned. I would prefer that we had some training available for staff, not just teachers, but all school staff, to be aware of medical signals from kids so that we could do a little preemptive kind of thing and get them help before we got to a crisis. And then we wouldn't need this. I think that's a pretty radical opportunity to have some things go wrong and be very expensive.
Representative Plum, closing comments on House File 675.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is the first committee to hear this. And this is the opening discussion. And we'll see what path the legislature and committees choose and see how it develops. And thank you for the time and opportunity to bring the subject before you.
Thank you, Representative Plum. The chair renews her motion that House File 675 be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Policy Reform. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails and the bill is re-referred. Thank you, Representative Plum. Speaker Thiessen, are you ready to present? I see you in the audience and I would like to honor your time. Members, we're going to move to House File 341. And Representative Lee, after Speaker Thiessen introduces himself, would you be so kind as to move the file? Welcome to our committee, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you in education policy. Please say your name for the record.
Yes, State Representative Paul Thiessen.
And welcome again. Representative Lee moves House File 341 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Thiessen, please present your file.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I did have, a witness, too, if he could just join me, if that's
excellent.
All right with the chair.
That would be just very good.
Thank you. And I'll just briefly go over it, and then the witness actually is from St. Thomas Law School, and they kind of worked on bringing this idea forward. So that's why he's joining me today. So this bill is, on its face, fairly straightforward. It requires cultural competency training and policies to be adopted related to really two areas. One, with referrals to special education, and secondly, with also some early interventions that we put in place to avoid getting kids referred to special education. And I want to first start by saying this, you know, this is not a silver bullet, or it's kind of a mediocre solution at best. But it's the start, I think, of a conversation that we need to have. And I do think it could have an impact in starting that conversation. That's what I really want to do. I just have a couple of facts I want to go over. And this is focused, you know, more on Minneapolis because that's my school district, but I think this is true in lots of places across the state. You know, there, we have this disparity between among ethnic groups about who's referred to special ed. 21% of African Americans were referred in the last 2 years. 25%, one in four American Indian students were referred to special ed in the last couple of years. As opposed to 13% of white students, you know, so double the, you know, well, not double, but significantly higher rates. And more specifically, looking at emotionally EBD in that area, over the last several years, you know, African-American students are put into EBD programs, you know, 4% of the student population is compared to less than 1% of white students, and among American Indians, it's just as bad or higher. And so that disparity exists, and these complaints, you know, they're not recent. They go back. There was a complaint filed in 1988 to try to address this disparity, and we just really haven't made much progress on it. And that's what's concerning to me. And, you know, why does this matter? Well, if you get referred, if you get labeled as EBD, you have a 40%, as I understand it, graduation rate in this state, you know, which is low. And when you get to these level four programs, so the, you know, most serious programs, you know, in Minneapolis, as an example, at the Harrison Education Center, we have a 6% graduation rate and a 4.5% proficiency in, they actually only can do it in math. They can't even do it in reading. Now, there's lots of reasons for that, obviously, but I do think one of the things we do when we label kids, and some kids need to have these services provided for them, but in many times, you know, we are really condemning them to academic failure in many ways, especially when they get into some of these level four programs in some of our districts. The research shows that poverty is a factor in this, and, you know, those socioeconomic factors, but that doesn't explain the whole disparity we have in referrals, and cultural bias plays a significant role as well. And so that's really what this bill is getting to. I just want two other things, then I'll turn over to the testifier. You know, in talking to parents and licensed social workers who work in this area, one of the other things that they have mentioned is that a lot of parents sign these documents, and for a variety of reasons, without really understanding these implications. And as we move forward, I think another thing that we should really think about is what kind of information and notice and explanation we give to parents before they actually sign documents, you know, putting, you know, direct, you know, sending their students down a particular path. I think that's a serious issue. And I also think, quite frankly, looking at the incredibly broad definition we have of EBD in this state, which basically you can fit just about any student. I mean, as I was reading through it, you know, and you have to have some, academic and or educational impact, but the initial assessment, all three of my kids probably fit one of them. You can either be too quiet or too loud, or you can be too aggressive or not aggressive enough. You know, there's. It basically encapsulates just about every behavior. Probably every one of us who has kids has seen in their kids at one time or another. So I think that's worth looking at beyond the scope of this bill, but I hope that that's something to proceed. But I'd like to turn it over to the testifier.
Welcome, sir, to our committee. Please say your name and begin.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is John Pauley, and I am a third-year law student at St. Thomas, where I'm also finishing my master's in public policy.
And will you spell your last name, please?
Sure. It is Pauley.
Thank you. I had it correct. Thank you. Please proceed.
During my second year, I worked in the St. Thomas Legal Services Clinic as part of the Community Justice Project. Here, I took over a research project that was previously started by another student. In short, we examined the negative academic consequences and damaging psychological effects caused by overdiagnosing students of color with emotional behavioral disorder. Emotional behavioral disorder, or EBD, refers to a disability in an educational setting due to poor social or academic adjustments that cannot be better explained through biological or developmental disabilities. For example, some of the behaviors associated include hyperactivity, panics, being socially withdrawn, exercising tantrums, acting defiantly, and arguing with authoritative figures. Now, I know we have a full list of bills today, so I'll be brief with our research. At the end of the day, this bill and the purpose behind our research is about one thing: closing the achievement gap here in Minnesota. Our research stems from a certain set of data, mainly students of color here in Minnesota were diagnosed with emotional behavioral disorder at more than four times the national average. This racial disparity was the highest among all 50 states. Now, when a certain student population is overdiagnosed, there are three issues that need to be addressed. First, why is there an overrepresentation? Differences in cultural norms often lead to misdiagnosing, which is where this bill's cultural competency aspect comes into play. For example, say we have two houses, each with its own social norm. It's not a matter of which one is right or wrong. Each household simply has its own different way of acting in group settings based on its own cultural norms and backgrounds. Second, what are the psychological effects of labeling a student with a learning disability that may not even be there in the first place? In their minds, these students are labeled as bad. There's a stigma attached that results in self-doubts and a lack of confidence. Therefore, a self-fulfilled prophecy arises, meaning a student begins acting out simply because they're expected to act out. And third, what are the fiscal impacts of an over-enrolled and over-diagnosed student population? A significant amount of resources goes into special education programs. These resources could be used much more efficiently if they were focused on the students that truly do have disabilities in the classroom. In closing, I'll say this. Every education committee here in the legislature shares common goals, one of which is to close the achievement gap. The achievement gap is a complex issue with no easy, no quick, nor single solution. Nevertheless, this bill and its emphasis on cultural competency is a step in the right direction if we're looking for classroom-based solutions that help close the achievement gap here in Minnesota. Thank you for allowing me the chance to speak, and I welcome questions as time permits.
Thank you, Mr. Colley. Representative Thiessen?
Yeah, I have one other testifier for just briefly, if the chair is okay.
Absolutely.
With that?
Okay. Please come forward. Mr. Colley, don't go away because I'm sure there are questions for you. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nakima Levy-Pounds, and I was a law professor at the University of St. Thomas during John Pauley Sr., and this was the research project that he was responsible for. And I just want to reiterate the importance of addressing the issue of cultural competency with regard to emotional behavior disorder. It's just one amongst many issues as far as the way that children of color in particular are being treated within the public school system. This issue came to our attention, number one, through a series of Star Tribune articles where they actually focused upon the racial disparity in overdiagnosing children of color with EBD, but they also looked at the fact that white children are also being overdiagnosed in the state of Minnesota, which is an issue from my perspective that has to do with competency on the part of those who are labeling children EBD, as well as the need for cultural competency. As Paul Thiessen talked about, one of the issues that continues to arise has to do with children being labeled EBD and winding up in what's known as the school-to-prison pipeline, how they're more likely to be sent to special education programs where they may be more likely to be around children who actually have more serious issues, and it has an impact on their behavior, it has an impact on their academic outcomes, and they may be more likely to wind up in the juvenile justice system. And once a child winds up in the juvenile justice system, there's a greater likelihood that he or she will wind up in the adult criminal justice system. So this has impacts far beyond education, and I would ask this committee to take a serious look at this bill as one step towards addressing the opportunity gap in education, as John talked about in his research.
Thank you, Ms. Levy-Pounds. Are there questions for these two testifiers? Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair.
in a little bit of background, I was an EBD teacher for a number of years, and I there's nothing wrong with your proposal. I think that it does hit upon some good things. However, I learned as an EBD teacher, I was in a level 5 program, and I talked with my supervisors and asked if I could be let go from the classroom for half a day to meet with teachers and talk with them about the students that they were having troubles with. And I'm just mentioning this as a possible addition to what you're thinking about, and that is that I have found that teachers oftentimes were motivated for good things, wanting to help a student who seemed to need help. And the answer that they were thinking was, let's get them to a place where they can get some help. My efforts in meeting with the teachers individually was to try to help them figure out how to keep that child in their classroom, how to work with them so that they could continue to be part of it, how to manage behaviors in a different way and understand that really all behaviors are a means of communication. And you can either try to belch that communication or you can try to understand it and listen to it and perhaps even grow a relationship that could be developing. And I think that the aspect that you're talking about with cultural understanding is really important and shouldn't be diminished. But I also wonder if whether this was a person that had cultural background or a deeper understanding of the emotional disabilities or problems that students might face, going and counseling with a teacher and changing that notion that the answer is to get that student out of the classroom rather than staying in the classroom is probably really important. And I guess my question is that something that you could think about? One last thing I want to say is that I think that the whole idea of this achievement gap, which is important for us to pay attention to, but exacerbates this problem. For some teachers who want to make sure they have high-performing students in their classroom, there's whether they're good-minded or not, there's a sense of wanting to move those students who need that extra help out of their classroom and somewhere else. And I think it's something we need to remind ourselves of, that that's a potential issue. So if you have any comments or about that, I'd appreciate it.
Ms. Levi Pounds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I would agree that it's important to have someone who is culturally competent helping to coach teachers around this issue. When we looked into some of the criteria for being able to diagnose students with EBD, that there was no requirement that the teacher have a bachelor's degree, for example, in psychology or anything specifically related to EBD. A master's degree in EBD would be sufficient. And so you may have people who had a discipline such as English, but going and getting a master's degree and a certification in EBD, able to actually diagnose people without enough training and history surrounding that particular issue. That leads to part of the problem as well. And so coaching, of course, is important to ensure that teachers know that there are other tools available for de-escalating behavioral problems within the classroom, and also making sure that they understand the consequences of pushing children out of the classroom who do not deserve to be pushed out of the classroom. Often they're sent to behavioral interventionists where they're not learning anything, or they're sent home, they're suspended for days at a time, and they come back and they're further behind. So I think as much as we can ensure that there are appropriate interventions in terms of how we address this issue along with other ways that we address special education will be critical in addressing this opportunity gap in education. I think parents would appreciate that as well, and being trained on how to address issues that may arise at home when their children are acting out.
Representative Bly.
Just one last comment. I was an English teacher that became an EBD teacher, so just so you know, and I understand what you're saying. One difference in the way that I looked at my job, though, was that I would not diagnose someone with EBD without the school psychologist backing me up or participating in that. And I think that's very important, that the EBD teacher is not skilled enough or not trained enough to do diagnosis and needs to have that extra help in order to do that. So I agree with you.
Thank you, Ms. Levy Pounds, for your testimony. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me. And welcome, Ms. Pounds.
to the committee. And I appreciate Representative Bly's questions, but I'm a little disturbed by the information I think I heard about what's common practice. And so being a layperson, I just want to be clear. So I understand Representative Bly would confer with a school psychologist, which I suspect are about as common as four-leaf clovers are in reality in our public schools. So what I want to know is, did I hear a testimony right that we have professionals who are teachers, good folks, who do not have any even undergrad training, content knowledge in the area of psychology that are diagnosing children to be eligible for EBD and then therefore placing them in EBD streams in our schools? Is that what's going on in reality?
Ms. Levy-Pounds?
Madam Chair, thank you. From our understanding, there does not need to be a background in psychology or anything having to do with medicine or mental health in order for someone to enter that field at the master's level and then go on to be certified. Our standards are different from what happens in other jurisdictions. It's much more rigorous in terms of the qualifications for someone to be at a level where they can diagnose children, you know, alone or in consultation with another professional. And I appreciate the representative saying that he consulted with the psychologist. But the reality is that, number one, those resources are typically scarce within many of our public schools. And beyond that, there's still an issue regarding a lack of cultural competency amongst some of our psychologists as well. You know, again, we're talking primarily about children of color, often from a lower socioeconomic background, and many of the professionals that they interface with do not share their same racial and ethnic background. And there's no real checks and balances to ensure that children are being diagnosed appropriately and that they're receiving care that will actually lift them outside of the achievement gap. As a matter of fact, a lot of them are languishing behind, as you heard from earlier testimony in terms of reading, mathematics, et cetera, and are less likely to graduate. So again, part of it is our structure and the criteria for who is actually able to diagnose. And we can miss that because someone has a master's degree and they're certified. But that doesn't mean that they actually have a long-term discipline in that area that should qualify them to make such a critical decision for vulnerable children.
And, Madam Chair, just to follow up, I need to follow up more on this, but one of the things I've been learning is that there are several school districts, because of this shortage, who contract with the Department of Education and have outside groups come in, and sometimes the people doing it are students or interns that, you know, are in a program to get to a mental health kind of or psychiatric degree, but they are not yet there. So they're relying on interns and students to make these diagnoses instead, which is also troubling to me, kind of going to your point.
Senator Mariani?
Madam Chair, this is disturbing to hear, quite frankly. And I've been here a while, and I've chaired this committee, and I wasn't even aware of this. So bad on me, but it seems to me that, you know, we've kind of scratched the surface of something here that really needs to dig into a lot more. And I would hope that we can do that in consultation with other people out in the field. But it's quite disturbing to me. Let me just ask one other question. Section 2 of the bill addresses the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act. And Ms. Pons, I think this gets at your testimony about, we have a system, quote unquote, that I would argue, based on what I heard here, doesn't even come close to maximizing, you know, sound professional standards relative to the labeling and placement of students in EBD and other special ed categories. But then there's this issue, and I think Representative Thiessen, I think it was, that read the connection between that and graduation rates and other negative outcomes. I suspect, including high rates of removal from classroom. So this now goes to practices relative to the dismissal of students from schools. Can you say more about why it's important to have culturally competent individuals involved in that process of dismissal of students from schools?
Absolutely. So, Madam Chair, in many of our public schools, particularly in urban areas, we have a very high percentage of white teachers and white administrators and a high percentage of students of color. And so primarily you have people of color who are the behavioral interventionists within the school or teaching assistants. And so when the decision makers have a cultural distance between children, it's very easy to overreact or misinterpret behavior or even to more harshly punish students of color for the same behavior that their white counterparts are engaging in. I know that your organization has been involved in looking at these issues and seeing particularly that black boys are more likely to be suspended, let's say in Minneapolis Public School District, for nonviolent offenses, such as, talking back to the teacher, doing things that are disruptive, that's the overwhelming majority of suspensions for a lot of African-American students. And it's similar with African-American girls as well. We've heard stories of girls in the classroom talking back to their teacher and being sent out. And sometimes they're actually suspended for that behavior. And it's very vague in terms of the reason and the rationale that's given for why they're being suspended. So I don't think that the dots are being connected between a teacher's desire to remove a student that he or she feels is disruptive from the classroom and how it is contributing to what we call the achievement gap. You know, as I referenced earlier, these students spending days at a time outside of school, being further behind in their classroom work, sometimes never even catching up, missing credits, and then ultimately a higher risk of not graduating. And so we need to make sure that we're monitoring this notion of implicit bias. We have a lot of police departments around the country that are now engaging in implicit bias training of officers because it's in someone's subconscious whether they hold stereotypes against another group or bias against another group. It may not be intentional on the part of that person, but it's because of the conditioning that we often have as a society that causes us to look at the other as less than and different, and we can respond in a way that perhaps we did not intend. And so for many of these situations, as far as suspensions are concerned, I believe that implicit bias plays a role in terms of harsher punishments and longer suspensions for students of color, as well as an increased likelihood of sending those students to the school resource officer, who becomes the de facto disciplinarian in most school settings.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's much more to dive into, but I know you've got other bills and other conversations. I appreciate us opening this vitally important issue. We're talking about 30% of the kids in our public schools, and that's only going to grow. And it seems to me that our ability to employ the full range of skills that's been developed out in the broader field, as you mentioned, Ms. Pounds, even our law enforcement communities, I know our St. Paul Police Department, has immersed itself increasingly in becoming knowledgeable about implicit bias, developing culturally competent skills, and interacting with an incredibly diverse community here. It sounds like it's time for our public schools to catch up with that as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. In defense of teachers, remember, they're decision makers. They make thousands of decisions in a day because every single thing you do in the classroom, you know, is based on a decision you have to make. And I do believe that we have a process in place for special education. So if it has gone awry, then we need to check that. But there is a process. Students are just not diagnosed by a teacher and placed in special education. There is a process to follow. So I honor that process that they follow, and I really believe they do their best to try to do that. But maybe we need to, provide, as you've suggested, and Dr. Polly, with more training. And certainly that should occur at the teacher preparation level for our new candidates.
and within staff development for the rest of our teachers. So thank you very much for being with us, and Dr. Pauly as well. Representative Thiessen.
If there's no other questions, just in closing, but first of all, thank you for holding the hearing, and I agree with Representative Mariani. I mean, this is a kind of a little bit of a sledgehammer approach to a much more nuanced problem, and I hope that we can have further discussion to kind of get at the details of it, although I also want to make sure we do it in a way that kind of respects each individual school district, which is kind of why I was drafted this way, to develop the policies that work for their district. I also want to say both my mom and my sister are EBD teachers, so I'm kind of coming at it from that perspective as well. And the last thing is, notwithstanding the Harrison School, I just do want to say in Minneapolis is actually making some improvements, and then over the last 2 or 3 years have made progress. I mean, the results are not there yet, but my understanding is that some of the within that building, there are changes being made, and I think it just shows the importance of good leadership at a site. And when you have good leadership, you can change, but if that goes away, that could slip back very much, which is why I also think we need to have good policies at the district level in place. So I really appreciate the time, and I think that there's more work that needs to be done to dive into this, but I appreciate you having the hearing, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Thiessen, and I know the department is here and they have been listening carefully, so I know Mr. Uni will take that back to Commissioner Caselius. With that, Representative Lee renews his motion that House File 341 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you very much to both of you testifiers and to you, Representative Thiessen. With that, members, we'll move to House File 538, Representative Christensen. Welcome to the testifying table, Representative Christensen. If you would move your House file, please, with the notation that it be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move House File 538 for possible inclusion in the policy omnibus bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Christensen. Would you explain your bill, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, this bill came about. We hear a lot of testimony in this committee about the importance of third grade and that students are reading at grade level by third grade, and how that is such an indicator for their performance going on in high school graduation rates, even in lots of their performance down the road. So recognizing the importance of third grade literacy and reading at grade level in third grade, this bill encourages school districts to work together with teachers, administrators, and parents in order to create a personalized learning plan for students who are not reading at grade level by third grade. Many school districts are doing this already, and that's fantastic. About half of school districts are not creating these plans. They are not conducting these interventions for students to make sure they're reading well by third grade, and I think the legislature recognizes the importance of that in this bill. Encourages school districts in a way that works best for their school districts. The bill is worded in a intentionally non-prescriptive fashion in order for school districts to have the flexibility to do what's best for their district and their students and community. The other important part of the bill that members should look at is at the end of the bill, it instructs that students who do not meet or exceed Minnesota academic standards as measured by the MCAs that are administered in high school shall be informed that admission to a public school is free and available to any resident under 21 years of age or who meets the requirements of Section 128.20, Subdivision 1, Paragraph C. So this just is kind of a encouragement or requires school districts to just inform students of their educational rights until they turn 21.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Do you have I think you do have testifiers who support this proposal. If they would come forward first, and then we'll hear from those with concerns. Welcome, Mr. Crossan. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Joshua Crossan, and I'm with Ed Allies, which is an education advocacy nonprofit that works to improve public education for each and every kid in Minnesota. Madam Chair, members, Ed Allies supports this bill, which is an important first step to improve literacy and inform and engage parents in their continued kids' learning and growth. The literacy provisions in this legislation mirrors work being done across the country, including in Colorado with the Colorado Reads Act, which is tackling childhood literacy by bringing together a team of adults to establish a personal learning plan for kids who are falling behind. As the old adage goes, kids learn to read, and by third grade they read to learn. And that adage is not only true, but it is affecting communities directly. As we know, the federal government plans prisons and increases law enforcement based on the literacy rates of third grade students. So it is imperative that we do everything we can to improve literacy for third graders. This effort also aligns with the amazing work of the Minnesota Reading Corps and district adopted programs, and would continue to personalize education for kids on IEPs while establishing a focused and personalized learning plan for those kids who just need a little bit more attention. The second part of this legislation provides students and their families more information on how our public education system has enabled them to achieve. We support this proposal because it gives students the choice, the flexibility, and the tools to continue their education to meet their individual learning goals, which is extremely necessary for English language learners and students with limited or interrupted formal education. I'd like to thank Representative Christensen for introducing this important legislation, and I hope we can continue to build on our laws that will improve literacy and create a more accommodating and transparent public education system for all of our kids. Thank you, and I'll be open for questions or around for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Crossan. Have you read some of the literacy plans that districts do post on their websites?
Yes, and I'm excited that those literacy plans could be adopted in other districts and replicated for all students.
Thank you, because I've read some, too, that I think do include personalized learning plans, and the district, I think, works hard to achieve that.
Definitely.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bartholomew. Welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House File 5358. We support this proposal because it focuses on helping students succeed at two critical points in their K-12 experience. As you've heard, early literacy is critical to student success, with students being four times as likely to drop out of high school if they aren't reading at grade level by the end of third grade. And while we've seen some overall improvement in reading statewide, it's been very incremental, with only 60% of our students reading at grade level. For our third grade students, only 57% are at grade level, and we still have significant gaps for students based on race and income. As a result, we think Representative Christensen's proposal asking schools to develop personal learning plans for students who are falling behind is reasonable. We also think it's good to emphasize that schools, to the extent they can, will work with the families of struggling students. As the department's recent survey of district implementation of our English language arts standards and interventions highlighted, only about half of our districts actively engage families when needed. We also support Section 2, the notification of high school students who aren't on track for being college and career ready, that they can continue to receive instructional services beyond the typical age of 18. As the handout that I think is in your packet from the Office of Higher Education shows, students who are meeting grade level math and reading expectations in our high school MCAs are far more likely to enroll in a post-secondary education and far less likely to need remedial coursework. And the best example of that is, as you're looking at it on the left-hand side, the first two columns show students who are meeting expectations on math and those who are not. In the top is enrollment in post-secondary, and the bottom is the need for remediation. and only 7% of kids who meet our math standards in high school need post-secondary remediation. While remaining in our K-12 system may not be a preferred option for every student, it can be a sound option for students who might otherwise graduate from high school and enroll in a post-secondary program, only to be later required to take a remedial course and then have to pay for it on their own. This is especially true given the recent Getting Prepared report that showed an increase in the percent of low-income students and students of color being referred to remedial courses. Overall, House File 358 focuses needed help for students at two critical points in their K-12 experience, and we'd ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Mr. Uni, on behalf of the department, I don't know if you could make some comments about the commissioner's review of literacy plans and what you might be seeing or not seeing. I know when we met with the governor the other day, Representative Mariani and I did hear the governor express shock at learning that only 60% of third graders are proficient before they enter the fourth grade. And I know he expressed a concern about that. So to what extent has the commissioner engaged in looking at literacy plans and herself intervening with school districts so that perhaps this legislation is not necessary? Mr. Mooney, please. Madam Chair, committee members, good morning.
Happy Valentine's Day. My name is Adosh Uni. I'm the Director of Government Relations with the Department of Education. Madam Chair, I haven't looked at exactly with our standards division as well as our early learning through third grade people in terms of what they look at specifically for literacy plans in terms of the components. I know that through our regional centers and through our staff, we work pretty closely with title schools who are having issues with meeting some of their goals, including reading proficiently by third grade. We are looking at what type of interventions and strategies we'll be engaging in when we start looking at districts achieving the world's best workforce. As you all know, one of the goals is reading well by third grade. So we'll be looking at that going forward, but I certainly will go back to the department and take a look at what we've looked at exactly pertaining to literacy plans.
Thank you, Mr. Oney. And when the department provides the incentive aid, the literacy incentive aid, what is the process there for determining whether a district receives the incentive aid?
Madam Chair, through I believe the literacy aid is based both on growth and proficiency, and I think it works out to about half the aid goes for awarding to districts that show growth on their reading proficiency or show growth on the reading scores, and then half goes for showing proficiency on reading scores.
Thank you, Mr. Oney. Are there questions for the department or, Representative Makewaite?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question. So, Representative Christensen, I'm going to talk to you about your bill because I love it and then I'm nervous about it. So what are currently the disparities between proficiency, and this could be for Mr. Oney, between students of color and white students? Do you know?
Mr. Oney.
Madam Chair, Representative Makewaite, I don't have the disparity data on hand right now. I can certainly go back and take a look at our report card and provide that information for you and the committee.
Mr. Oney, I think that would be valuable for us since we're laying this over for possible inclusion. Representative Makewaite.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Christensen, I just want to say again, I would love to work with you on this because I think it's the retention piece that really is holding me back on this, no pun intended, because we know that students of color are held back twice as much as their white peers. We just heard a presentation on how we're over enrolling students in special ed, EBD, and so I get nervous that this would apply here as well, that we would have more students of color held back. We know that when they're held back, they don't do better. And so that's my fear with this one piece of an otherwise good bill.
Representative Christian's response?
Just very quickly, Madam Chair, Representative Makewaite, to address the first question, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but like most areas of the achievement gap, it's quite significant. To talk about the grade retention, I'm in the bill, that's listed as under May. The school district's May, and it's just listed in a list of several other strategies that the school districts may employ. So I think it's important that we know it's just listed as a number of things that school districts can use as tools and as part of a plan to meet the best needs of the student.
Representative Makeway.
Madam Chair, and to your point, Representative Christensen, I think the fear is that oftentimes with students of color, the May becomes overused, and then students of color are more often held back. And so I do understand that it is optional, but that a lot of times that becomes the norm for students of color. So that's my fear.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Christensen, for bringing this bill forward. Very similar struggles in a way of the pros, but also maybe the cons of this bill. And I just have a question about paperwork and the amount of time it takes. I know in my school we are constantly assessing our students, you know, guided reading and so on, determining their weaknesses, trying to work with those skills that are needed for students. Has anybody looked at the amount of time this will take a classroom teacher? Let's say we have a classroom of 28 kids. I'm not sure exactly what 40% is. I only taught first grade, so we didn't work with percentages. But let's say there's 12 kids that need this learning plan. What concerns me is what I see happening in special ed, now moving into the regular ed where we're loading our teachers with paperwork, can be good, but it also takes away from instruction because we only have so many hours a day to teach, and I'm concerned that we're going to lose more teaching time, which is critical, too. So what is the balance? Have we looked at how much time this will take for our teachers?
Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Bennett, when I first started looking at this bill, those were some of the similar concerns that I had. I've been, in my time in the legislature, really supportive of paperwork reduction in special education to make sure teachers' jobs are to teach, and that's largely where their time is best spent. This bill is very specific to describe that this is not an IEP. This is not an individualized education plan. The bill is intentionally somewhat vague in the language of what it asks the school districts to do in order to allow the school districts to develop a plan that works best for their teachers and for their students. And I think it's the idea behind that is that the school districts would engage their teachers in a conversation about how best to go about this. So it's not like special education in an IEP where there's very specific forms from the federal government and the state government, and there's all these different forms. This is a plan that would be put together by the school districts with the input of the teachers, presumably, and I think that's an important difference.
Members, I'm going to move on to the teachers who've come to testify today, and then I'll call on you to ask your questions. So if you don't mind, Representative Christensen, I'm going to call forward any of the teachers who've come. Some are reading specialists, reading interventionists, to hear from you. If you'll begin, please say your name for the record and explain to us your concerns.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Rachel Chamley, and I am a reading interventionist and a peer coach in the Prior Lake Savage Area School District, specifically at Redtail Ridge Elementary.
Welcome, Ms. Chamley.
Thank you. So we are here today. We share support for the same goal. We are teachers. We all want our students to be able to read, and we know that being able to read well by third grade does support and predict their future success in the workplace. We do have concerns, however, that we will speak to, and I am going to speak specifically to our concerns about the resources. We feel that this is not a cost-neutral bill. The concerns that were brought up with the time and paperwork, these are decisions that should be made by a team. You know, speaking from a reading interventionist perspective, these are things that we are already doing and seeing success with. It takes a team approach with parents and classroom teachers and specialists. The workload goes far beyond 1 hour with what we're already doing, so we are concerned about adding another layer of paperwork and time on top of that for everyone involved, parents, specialists, and classroom teachers. We also want to point back to the research on using our resources that we currently have towards early intervention versus third grade. We feel that third grade is too late. There's a lot of research out there about early intervention, even prior to when they come to school. So what can we be doing to educate our parents on literacy skills, and skills that aren't hard for parents to teach, just spoken language, reading, singing, things like that that would help predict students' abilities by the time that they get to us when they are in kindergarten. It does need to be a living document, which goes back to the time factor. You know, this is something we would want to revisit often. We look at multiple data points. We're trying to triangulate our data and look at that. So the concern over looking at just their one third grade MCA score is something that really concerns us as well. That's just a snapshot in the time of 8 years by the time they're in third grade. So as educators, we really support the overall goal. However, we do ask that you consider to amend it to recognize the things that we are already doing and that are working, and instead maybe focusing our resources on the gaps with parent education and early education intervention.
Thank you, Ms. Chamblee. Next, please.
Madam Chair.
Representative Christensen.
Quickly, thank you, Ms. Chamblee, for testifying. I'm in front of our committee, and I hope you'll tell my mother, who's a teacher at Red Tail Ridge Elementary, hello for me.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. I'm sure they'll do that. Welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Ellen Amney. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm a reading interventionist at Westwood Elementary in Prior Lake Savage School District. Our district is proud to offer a strong RTI response to intervention model for all students. I want to tell you about a third grader that I'm going to call Peter. For all but 5 months of Peter's education, his instructional needs have required Tier 2 reading intervention. That means he qualifies for intense reading and writing instruction. He receives a daily 30-minute lesson from a licensed teacher using a strong research-based curriculum in a group of 3 to 4 peers. A book at his reading level is sent home every night, along with homework that his parents are encouraged to do with him. This intervention is in addition to the classroom core instruction of reading and writing that he receives every day. Peter attended summer school after second grade and after first grade. He also receives a Tier 3 reading intervention. This means that every morning, Peter's teacher spends 3 to 5 minutes with him on a research-based reading intervention that has been selected specifically to meet his individual needs, and Peter is making growth. It's very tiny growth, but he's making growth. We are all working hard so that Peter can read at grade level by the end of third grade, because Peter deserves this without a doubt. Peter's scores are much higher on math assessments. He loves to tell stories about spending time outdoors with cousins. He requires multiple reminders to stay focused on the task at hand, especially when it comes to reading and writing, because they're difficult for him, and he knows. And he's quick to tell you that he hates reading because he's bad at it. I met Peter when he was 5. He believed that the first day I met him at 5 years old. Peter has been assessed 3 times a year using the NWEA Measures of Academic Progress, or MAP, test. His MAP scores range from the 1st to 29th percentile. He takes the test in anywhere from 15 to 35 minutes. His predictive MAP score in January of 187 says that Peter will not pass his MCA reading exam. I know that right now. He won't do it. Despite years of intervention, one-on-one, and small group instruction that has been intensive, Peter will not read at grade level by the end of third grade. There are too many factors beyond my control, the school's control, and even Peter's control. Background knowledge, a strong literacy foundation from age birth to 5, self-esteem, parental support, the amount of background noise in the computer lab where he takes the MCA exam, even the breakfast that he eats or doesn't eat that morning. I support wholeheartedly the notion that all children should read at grade level by the end of third grade, and I believe that teachers are working day and night so that their students have the best possible chance to do just that. Please, continue to offer these teachers and their students the resources and support that they need to strive towards that success. Do not place arbitrary test scores, expectations, and additional regulatory steps in their way. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abney. And remember, the world's best workforce is strive. Thanks for using the verb. You strive to do that. We have also with us Ms. Anderson. Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Melanie Anderson, and I'm also an elementary reading specialist at Glendale Elementary in Prior Lake. I think that this plan is not necessary. Like you've heard, we already are doing a lot of these things. It will add to our workload, take time away from our students. Mostly I want to speak to the part of this bill that talks about retention, and I know that you mentioned it's there as an option, but even saying that it's an option is really big and worrisome. Retention based on a third grade reading MCA score means that child would repeat third grade, the entire third grade, not just reading, the entire third grade. Every activity, every song they sang, every book they read, every science lesson, every math lesson, they would repeat that entire year based on one day, one reading test. That doesn't seem to go hand in hand. It doesn't seem like what that student would need at all. In my school, there's currently 110 fifth graders, and of those fifth graders, when they were in third grade, only seven of the general education students didn't pass their reading MCAs. We didn't retain them. We let them go on to fourth grade. Some of them got intervention services. Some of them didn't need it. Some of them were great students. They just didn't pass their third grade MCAs. It was the first time they took it. Who knows what happened, right? So at the end of fourth grade, of those seven, only two didn't pass their reading MCAs. We worked really hard. Again, some we didn't even need to work hard. They would have passed anyways. We don't need this plan saying they should have been retained. What would we have done to them if they were retained? We also have experience with a first grader who came to school without kindergarten. He did not have kindergarten. He was very behind. And we thought at the end of the year, we gave him many interventions. He had tier two. He had tier three. He did before school. He did summer school. We thought maybe we do need to retain him in first grade. But looking at the whole child, looking at his social and emotional needs, we thought as a team that wasn't necessary. He needs to go on, and we are supporting him, and he is making growth. In second grade, we continue to support him, tier two, tier three, reading intervention, summer school, before school. In third grade, the student did pass his MCAs and is in fourth grade and is not receiving any intervention services. So the need for early intervention, what we did in first grade, is what made a difference in this child's reading career so far in his life. There are good values in this bill. All teachers with their heart, I mean, I feel like we're almost all tearing up, like talking about these students that come from our heart. We put a lot of time and energy into them. But it needs revision and rethought, and there could be so much more energy and effort put into earlier intervention to make a difference by third grade.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson, and perhaps you'll work with the author with some ideas that you have. We have one last testifier.
Madam Chair, very quickly.
Who's a teacher. Yes, Representative Christian.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just to thank you, Ms. Anderson, for your testimony. And as a Glendale Elementary alum, that's one of the reasons I'm passionate about this bill, is because the intervention in Glendale does a great job. Prior Lake does a great job. And I'm the intervention at Glendale Elementary helped me learn how to read. And I'm hopeful that other school districts that are not doing these services can use districts like Prior Lake and schools like Glendale as a model as they form their own plans.
Thank you, Representative Christensen. Yes, we need to remind other schools to read other school literacy plans, because I've read a lot of them and I see lots of good in many of them. Welcome to our committee, and say your name for the record and begin.
Hello, my name is Liam Weichel. I'm a first-grade teacher. I teach at Jeffers Pond in Prior Lake Elementary. I am a 24-year educator. I spent my first 6 years in education teaching and reading intervention. In the last 18 years of my life, I've dedicated to teaching kids to read in first grade. I'm here to, again, thank you for caring about kids learning to read. We want to suggest the idea that learning to read by the end of third grade is too late. I hope you're hearing that message. We're all trying to make that point very specifically. We're asking that the language in the bill be changed and amended. A couple of specific points is that in a child's life, and we're talking about children, passing the third grade MCA is one test, 1 hour on one subject, one moment of time in their entire academic career at that point. In our district, we currently follow the best practice of triangulating all assessments before we make decisions on student needs. We, and I don't want to insult anybody, but we don't necessarily value the MCAs as much as maybe the state does. It's one test, and so as a district, both where I teach and where I live in Lakeville, we also administer something called the MAP. We also give AIMS. We also are instructed to do something called the Developmental Reading Assessment. When all of those things give us the data and the information about students' learning, then we make decisions that are going to affect the rest of their lives. And I want to talk to you about ACE student, because these are real kids with real needs, real hopes, and dreams. There was a first grader who entered kindergarten, and we know through interview her parents made sure she was read to, was fed, had life experiences, showed up ready to learn. By the end of kindergarten, she proved she knew her alphabet sounds. She entered first grade and didn't succeed as a reader. Everything said she should. The question was why. She had a very highly effective first grade teacher, Barb Belinke, who thought, you know what, maybe it's her vision. Have you taken her to a doctor? Has she seen your optometrist? She passed the near-far chart that we administered in school, but maybe it's something like that. The child was taken to an optometrist, and they did something called the binocular function. It was her vision. But now at the end of first grade, she's not reading with her peers. Got glasses, started the medical help she needed through the eye doctor. We gave tier two intervention all through second grade, all through third grade. By the end of third grade, she still wasn't meeting or wouldn't on today's MCAs meet, which means she would be considered for retention. And you've heard about that. And a statistic that wasn't mentioned earlier is 4 out of 5 kids that are retained because of the social-emotional damage done to that don't ultimately end up graduating. And that's something we need to account for. This student went on into fourth grade, did well in her standardized testing. By the end of sixth grade, she got a near-perfect score on her standardized testing. All along in her career, she was achieving in social studies, science. She was active in sports. She got perfect scores in math. Everything else said she was doing well. This child went on to go on to, in sixth grade, being recruited by the University of Minnesota to come to school full-time. She went on to go to the United States Naval Academy and is currently serving in our military. She works in D.C., has served at the Pentagon as the youngest officer there at the time. She would have been eligible for retention under this bill. What we're concerned about is the vagueness of it. I know Representative Drew thinks that's a positive. We have a plan in our district. I was at our school board meeting last night. It's a comprehensive intervention plan, pre-K through 12. We give interventions. All this plan would do is add a level of bureaucracy that we don't have time for. As a classroom teacher, I want to spend my time on individual learning, on differentiating my curriculum, on the day-to-day lessons that we each do every single day. Your plan could hold a child back like Sienna, and I'd like to see that change. So we're asking that the language be changed and do more to actually support the kids pre-K through second grade, because at the end of third grade, it's simply too late. Remember, it's one test, 1 hour of their life, one subject matter, no matter how much they excel in other areas, and one moment in time for them. We're open for questions if anybody has questions. And thank you, Madam Erickson.
Thank you, Ms. Weichel. We're going to move on to the last testifier, Mr. Millenhagen. Thank you very much, teachers, for taking time out. Welcome to our committee. Say your name for the record. We just have a couple of minutes, so if you could be quick, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Millenhagen. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association. like to thank Representative Christensen for the intent in this bill and for what it allows possibly children to experience. We have some clarifications for it. We would like to limit to some extent the verbiage around requiring intensified in line 1.13, 1.18 shall receive, and 1.22 shall address. Those absolutes are a little intense for, as you heard the teachers explain what happened or what goes on in the classrooms and the schools and the kind of work we do, they limit our ability to serve children. And I'll say two more things, really. I'm going to give you a little gift today. I'm going to give you an activity that you'll be able to do two things at one time. If you'll do this little activity, it'll bring you all the way back to when you were learning how to read. Typically, you had someone that was very caring and kind and generous and thoughtful and patient with you when it came time for you to read. First thing you do is write the alphabet on a piece of paper. The second thing you do is you put symbols underneath the alphabet. Any symbol, doesn't matter, boxes, diamonds, squares, circles, birds, trees, whatever you'd like. And then the second thing you'll be able to get done today, because in your mind while you're doing this work, you also have a Valentine in your life that you would like to share a message with. And the part that'll take you the longest trying to figure out what the message you're going to share, if you use a short message and match the symbols with the letters in your message and have your Valentine decode that message. And then have your Valentine respond to you with another message. That will bring you back to the hardest job you've ever done in your life. You don't know it now because you're past it, for those of you that are here. For children that are in the middle of that, the hardest workers in our society, I believe, are first grade students, kindergarten students learning how to read. And then the even harder part is when they're learning how to read and they know they're not doing well. The people that you've heard from earlier here are skilled and professionals. Principals have the responsibility to design those lessons and those programs and those support and intervention systems to serve those children. World's Best Workforce really answers this plan question for us. I would say two more things. The local impact cost of creating these kinds of interventions and programming within a district, they'll need to include things like busing for summer school, staffing for those additional programs after school, and then to go back to what the teachers have said, each school has a team of people that really specifically designs a program for an individual child and what they need. And the last thing I'll say is, the concept of retaining children in third grade has been around politically for the last 4 or 5 years. There's other states that have done it. Minnesota is a state that really doesn't promote it, and mostly because most of the principals believe and the educators that the return on retention is really, really low and to a lot of extent poor. And it especially shows up when people become young adults. The experience of failure in the middle grades and later grades is so hard to overcome that I would encourage us, and hopefully that if this bill moves forward, that we don't include that option in the bill so that people feel like it's a good idea and a good way to go. It's an absolute last resort. The only time we really used that would be in the early grades, or if you had extremely specific incidents. Maybe a child that came in that was a fourth grader or would be an age for appropriate for fourth grade, that came from another country, didn't have language in their own or schooling in their own experience. And even at that time, we were significantly reserved in utilizing that strategy. So I'd like you to be real sensitive to that component. There's a full array of other options to use other than retention. Thank you for your time. Thank you, Representative Christensen,
and Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Miller-Hagan. Yes. And members, we have to move on. We have Mr. Representative Bly's bill. So with that, Representative Christensen, I'm going to bypass you and simply renew your motion that House File 538 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Christensen.
Thank you,
Representative
Chair.
Bly, I'm sorry that this has gotten so long for you. And you have an amendment, too. So, members, please have 281.
So, first I should, Madam Chair, first I should move my bill, is that?
Representative Bly, welcome to our committee. Please move House File 281 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
So moved. Yes, and as you're right, I do have a...
And you have an amendment. So, Representative Bly moves Amendment A1. Will you just explain what that does, Representative Bly?
It replaces the word Latin with a classical language, which is what the advocates of the bill requested. So
members, on lines 115 and 118, we are deleting Latin and replacing it with classical language. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted, and your bill is in its order, Representative Bly. Please explain. This is very interesting.
Madam Chair, in the interest of time, I'm just going to say this idea was brought to me last year near the end of session and wasn't able to introduce it as a bill. We did attempt to introduce an amendment to the omnibus bill that really didn't work out. But what I'd like to do is bring forth the testifiers to come right away and testify when you're on that chair, too. And let them talk about their idea rather
Thank
than
you,
my
Representative Bly
going
for,
down the process here.
For allowing these teachers to come and to share why this would be a good move for our students. Welcome to the committee, please. Please say your name and begin.
My name is Emma Shadrew. I'm from Edina High School.
Go ahead and give your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Education Committee, for this hearing, and thank you, Representative Bly, for proposing the amendment that would allow classical students an equitable access to the seal of biliteracy, and we hope for all of your support on this. We are representing 44 schools in Minnesota that teach Latin, and we are supported by the Classical Association of Minnesota, teachers and professors of classics in Minnesota. We are also supported by the national organization, the American Classical League. You are going to find letters of support of these parties in your packet that is going out. I would also like to recognize Kathy Smith, Latin teacher and curriculum director of the Liberty Classical Academy, in the audience. I grew up in Hungary, and I started my first foreign language, Russian, in sixth grade. Then in high school, I started Latin, and when I got to college, I started English. English was the easy language to learn because of Latin. English is a very hard language because of the vocabulary and the pronunciation. I'm still struggling with that, as you can tell. But I had an awesome advantage with Latin because I could read English before I could even speak it, because I understood the language, I understood the vocabulary, and if you have pushed through students on SAT tests, you know how important the vocabulary is, and the English language, over 70% is coming from Latin. So my advantage was great because I was an English student, but for my students who are studying Latin, their English skills are so much more strengthened by learning Latin that it's described by the SAT scores that are always consistently higher for Latin students than any other foreign language students. And this is just a fraction of why Latin is beneficial and should be considered. But I want to say that this language is under fire with the biliteracy bill. On April 29th, 2016, it was a sad day in Latin at Edina High School. This was the day of the Academic Awards ceremony. and all the modern languages, French, Spanish, German, and Chinese students walked the stage. They were awarded the biliteracy seals from Minnesota, except for the Latin students. And if you're asking what kind of students are the Latin students, I have to say that I had 32 students take the National Latin Exam. 27 of them got awards, 8 of them gold medals. And these achievers, including AP students, which is one of the hardest AP tests, were not able to walk the stage. I hope that you are not questioning that they are not proficient in Latin. But this law is not showing that they are proficient, and they were not able to walk up with their peers on that stage and receive a biliteracy seal. So this is where I think we need an amendment that would allow them the equitable access to the seal. And I would like to just move it on to...
Thank you, Ms. Drew, and I was fortunate to have 2 years of Latin in high school, so I feel akin to you in your comments about how much easier English is when you have studied Latin. Ms. Howe, welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you. Mary Howe, and thank you, Madam Chair and committee, for allowing us to share our thoughts on this bill, and thank you to Representative Bly for bringing it forward for us. I'd like to thank the legislature for passing the law on the biliteracy seal in the first place, because it does recognize the value of world languages in high school and, frankly, in middle school, and that's important to us. We appreciate that. However, we'd like you to consider a little bit further with regards to Latin students and classical language students. This biliteracy seal should be available to all students, and at this point, it's virtually impossible for Latin students to achieve this seal, because of the nature of classical languages. Latin specifically, we train these students to read and interpret text, to work very closely and very deeply with written text. Buying carrots in Latin is not something that we need to train them to do. That's not a real-world skill. That's not something they're going to be going on and doing in college or in the real world anywhere, really. So what we focus on, what we concentrate on, really the ultimate goal of Latin is reading and understanding the text. And modern languages, it's wonderful that they test, they teach, they work in all of the four different modalities, speaking, reading, writing, listening. In Latin, we use some of those modalities in class, but we use them in order to help the students become better readers of this literature, of epic poetry, of love poetry, of court cases and lawyer speech. And so we have very different goals from the modern languages. And our students who work very hard and are very competent in their language are being denied this this seal. Basically, the law as it stands now says that they have to test in all of the different modalities. And whatever their lowest level is, that's their overall rating. So our students are testing very high in interpretive reading, but if we were to give them a standard test, which, by the way, does not exist in reading or speaking Latin, they would score very low. These are not modalities that we train the students to be able to perform on. We use them to help them develop their reading skills, but we don't teach them to have conversations in Latin. So if we were to test them on that, their scores would, in fact, be very low, and they still wouldn't qualify for a seal. And I say if a test exists, because it does not exist. We would have to create a test and give to them. That would alter how we teach them, what we do with them in class, because we'd be pushing them to achieve higher scores on that. And I think Emisha has some additional information on that.
Thank you very much, Ms. Howe. Ms. Drew?
So the two evidences that I think stand out most is the first one is that we have a proficiency test that was created by the American Classical League, our National Organization for Classical Languages, and ACTFL, the American Council for Teaching Foreign Languages. And these two organizations are the authorities that we believe should be producing a proficiency test for Latin. It exists, and we are questioning why we are not trusting, why is it not enough for Latin to be tested at that. If our national organizations, both for foreign languages and classical languages, agree that that is the appropriate way of testing a Latin or classical student. The second argument I have is assessments will influence teaching. If we start testing oral proficiency in Latin, it is going to become an exit skill and take away the time and energy from an ultimate goal to interpret Latin text. We don't test French students on their acting ability. However, role-playing is a very important part of the teaching process, right? There are a lot of things we do in classroom that we don't have to test because it's not the ultimate goal of that language. So we are arguing to have us test our students and have us concentrate on what is important and let the other modalities, the speaking, writing, and listening, be there. We are strong supporters of that. It's enlivening our classrooms, but they are not end skills, and they would distract our students from the end goal.
Thank you, Ms. Drew. And I believe we have other testifiers. I see two persons sitting in the audience. Is it Mr. Mackin? Please come forward. And thank you, Ms. Drew and Ms. Howe, for testifying. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Michael Mackin. I first took Latin at Edina with Emisha Drew here and Mary Howe. I graduated in 2012. Later on, I took the AP Latin test, scored a 5 on that, and I decided to major in Latin at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota. Currently, I'm a kindergarten through 8th grade Latin teacher at St. Francis Xavier School in Buffalo, Minnesota. I just want to say that AP Latin prepared me perfectly for college-level Latin. In the first semester of my freshman year at St. John's, I took a upper division, a 300-level Latin class, and I was more than satisfactorily prepared. I did fine in the class. There was no speaking component. There was no composition component in that class beyond being able to read the text out loud. So, and then later on at St. John's, I decided to take Greek, which my Latin preparations in high school helped me get ready for that. And then I took German in my senior year and was able to speak German by the end of that. In my opinion, Latin is a challenging but immensely rewarding language to learn. It didn't just help build my vocabulary, but it also completely changed my understanding of grammar. Learning Latin grammar can pretty much help you learn any grammar of any language, at least in the European tree. Beyond the language itself, the cultural and historical knowledge I acquired through my classical education has vastly expanded my worldview. Latin helped me and many other students I know become successful students and citizens. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to all of the testifiers. Representative Bly, closing comment.
Yes, one of the things that interested me about this bill was that in working with students who struggled to learn how to read, I discovered that teaching aspects of Latin or some of the grammar of Latin really helped them. And it was interesting to me the ideas that they brought forward, and which is why I was persuaded to bring forward this bill.
Thank you, Representative Bly. Mr. Uni, did you have a comment from the department? I'm sorry that I didn't call on you. Welcome, Mr. Uni. Please say your name. And
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Adoshini, Department of Education. I'll keep my comments brief. I think the department and its staff think that there is very valuable to create recognition for classical languages. They're valuable skills in many career areas. I would caution putting classical languages only the requirement of reading and understanding cultural perspectives through the same pathway or model as other languages that do require all four modalities. We may look at it as kind of an equity issue. So I would say that we would be very open to working with the author and the advocates on maybe creating another pathway towards recognition. I know that it's not just the recognition of the seals Getting that award for the students for their work that they've done, but it's also tied to college credits as well. So we're very open to working with the advocates and the author on this.
Thank you, Mr. Ooney, and we look forward to that. And with that, the chair renews Representative Wise's motion that House File 281, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. It is laid over, and members, this meeting is adjourned.